Hey, I am Ginger C. I'm recovered compulsive overeater. I love you guys too so much. And someone told me, if you get all nervous, pick your best friend, put her in the front seat of the row, and she'll just smile at you the whole time you talk. So, Jean Marie, I'm looking at you. Yeah, it's emotional because not long ago I was dying in the food, and my family's in the room tonight. Yeah. And, you know, we've been talking, and I just had no idea. You just don't think that you're affecting those around you because you're in isolation, because that's what addiction's all about. And I was eating in my bedroom, and they're telling me, you know, they were really concerned for my health and that I may die or get diabetes, and just the pain that they were walking with me silently. Because as I've shared on the line, my husband was so amazingly unconditional. And he just loved me. He didn't get on top of me. He was not a neck killer. And he just, you know, he was concerned, but he knew he was powerless. He's in 12-step himself. So thank you, John. And so thank you, God. Always giving credit where credit's due. I don't do this stuff. You know, if I could, I would have. And it's just the grace of God, like my sponsor said. You know, my window rolled down, and I let God in. And I think the most desperate prayer that all of us say, and this is where the beginning began for me, was I knew I was dying. I get suicidal when I eat sugar. It's only time it happens, but it happens, and it was real. And I was dying, and I said that most desperate prayer. I said, God, help me. God, help me. And that's what happens. We seek. We seek, and the gift is it's only down deep within. It's not far to find, and thank you, God, for that. So welcome, welcome. And like our co-founder says on Vision, welcome home. Welcome home. You're home. I always thought it was the Brady Bunch. It's OA. It's you guys. Because you speak my language. When my sponsor talks about heroin, I'm like, oh, God, shoot me up right now. You know, comfortably numb. Get me out of this skin. I can't stand another second. And I know the answer, to eat and to eat. And once I start, I cannot stop. I sometimes take my husband's 4-step inventory, and I look at his eating, and I'm like, you know, I don't think you're one of us, because he had a box of M&M or Milk Duds the other day on the nightstand, and he ate 5, and he left the box, and 2 days later, the box was still with the same amount inside, and I said, that's not me. Once I start, that box is gone, and I'm to the dollar store, because they got the big boxes of candy, and I like my candy. So that's what's happened for me, this transformation. Thank you, God. 24 years sober, sitting in AA with a very shiny medallion, thinking I was all that. Because I have a really big ego. You know, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. And sick, sick, sick. Thank God it's just a daily reprieve. We got a lot to do. And I'm glad I get to do this work. And I'm glad that God disturbs me, because it reminds me. And what is my biggest problem? Incredibly short memory. Oh, it wasn't that bad. It was that bad. It was that real. It was my life. So I'm so grateful we get to remember and how this mysterious, miraculous God works. Because my Evie kept sending me texts. She was having her body transformed, her mind, her thinking. And I saw it, but I was eating. I didn't want what you have. When you're in the food, you don't want God. You want the food. And she kept sending these texts. And thank God she did, because don't you know, one day she sent a text and she said, Ginger, the big book is starting over today in Vision. This can be your day. Start. Start with us. Start fresh. And watch your life unfold in a way you've never seen it before. I still didn't care about Vision. I still didn't care about her text. But don't you know that text came through September 17th, 2015. And what is that day? That day is my husband's birthday. And don't you know what greater gift you can give those loved ones that are standing by, but to come home, return, and connect. Because life is about love and connection. It's not about isolation and pain and disease. But I'm a sick person. I'm a really sick. I'm the summer program. Some are sicker than others. And Kinji, I don't get you. When you talk about stopping drinking and not getting high in Costco, I'm like, oh my God. I'm like shopping crazy. You know, that's my final frontier is money drunkenness. Hello, DA. I thought it was food, but oh well. Hopefully whack-a-mole is going to get unplugged. But, you know, the gift is I did make my plane ticket to Virginia Beach, and I did not want to go. And a lot of you know my story. I showed up with a backpack filled with my candy. I did not want to go. I looked at every restaurant as I went to the hotel as to where I would go the next day and binge my brains out. I was eating. I don't stop. But again, this God loves me so much. And I said that simple prayer, God, help me. And you don't know. Only God sees around corners. And God put the fork down on that Friday at that vision meeting when we were all sitting, they were sitting for the first time in a circle, and they were all really excited to finally see one another. And I felt that love, and I felt that power. And then I just told this lady, I got my candy in my bedroom, and I'm just a mess, and I don't know what I'm doing. And then I was sobbing to Larry Kay, and I said, I just want to eat Fannie Mae, you know, because if I'm going to stop, I'm going to go get every last bite before I say goodbye. And I have to go to San Francisco. I got to go to Chicago. I had to go to New York for a Cronut. I mean, this is my mind. This is how I work. And how can I get to all those places? And I can't. But, you know, this man stands by the door, like Kenji so beautifully read yesterday. And he was standing by the door. And he still stands today. It's amazing. I was always amazed working with him because I'm like, how do you do this? You work with others, you have a family. And he's always there. He's always available, just like Charles H. never stops. Never stops. And we can't afford to stop. We can't afford to stop. Because once you start resting on laurels, your mind is so crazy, you'll start believing those lies and you'll be eating. So I pray each and every one of you, anyone in the food tonight, take a date, put the fork down. That's what I did in Virginia Beach. I didn't even do it, though. It was a total grace of God. And then I got into action because when, I forget the page, but it's 25. Can you recite it, Larry? When the person's presented, it's just pick up the practical, just get into action. I forget, it's 25. Read the paragraph. It's really good and it's really real. You know, when you find that person, and there's plenty of recovered people, there's plenty of people that are out of the food tonight sitting here. Don't leave this convention, this retreat. Reach out, find somebody, and get into action. That's all we have to do. It really is such a simple program, but my mind really always messes with me. So I got to tell you, I knew this retreat was going to rock. We had ketchup last night at dinner. And somebody in the back knows what that's about. But no, more than that, this committee, I just have to give such a shout out. What a phenomenal retreat. Like, to me, God is the great outdoors. So thank you. Yeah. Big round of applause to the committee and a huge round of applause. She's very quiet. She's not Jen A or Ginger C. We are bouncing. This one's quiet, but she works just as hard and such a silent with so much humility. And so I really want to give a huge round of applause because you're sitting here tonight enjoying Kim G and this amazing recovery and these friends around you and this fellowship and this connection because of Carrie S. And I just have to say, Carrie S., it's amazing, two things she did, and it just floored me because it's like, what great service. She got billboards and messages at the bus stops in Denver. You're waiting for that bus, especially when it snows, it's late, and you get to look at this bus sign that says, if you're in the food and you're suffering, there is hope. Call OA. And Carrie got those all around Denver for our city. And not only that, she has natural grocers doing OA meetings. And what another great place to be bringing this message, because we know there are many. And we have to be ready and available and out there and doing it. Live meetings, people. I just love the live meetings. So With no further ado, I have to say, as I said, he stood by the door for me. He stands by the door for many, many. I've watched him now for almost 3 years, and it has been nothing. His talk matches his walk. He does not have pixie dust. I promise you that. I asked him many times. But he will take you through this practical program of action. He will always guide you through the big book. He's a therapist, but he's never tried to therapize me once. It's always the book and the directions, these clear-cut directions, because all my answers are solved in him, and he just points out where it lies. So with no further ado, I welcome Larry Kay from...
Come off. No, probably not. Hi, I'm Harlan G, and I am from sweltering Arizona. I hope we recorded that, Harlan. No, I'm Larry K. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. Can you guys hear me okay in the back? Yes? No? It's not working. There we go. I kind of want to take this off. All right, now I feel comfortable here. Okay, and you can hear me okay in the back? Okay, good. Ginger, where's Ginger? There you are. Thank you so much. Yeah. You know, I related to Ginger because I came to a convention like this and years ago, and I had candy up in my room. So when she shared that with me, I could relate to that. And I meant, when I said I wasn't going to eat the candy, I meant it. And I told myself that, I mean, how can you eat when you're here? Oh, there's someone in the room that has. Right? And it was me back in the day. It was me. And this whole practical program of action is about identification. And Kim's done such a wonderful job taking us through the steps. I'm really going to just kind of do sort of a qualification and maybe talk a little bit about the notion that we can't stop. If we can't stop and we can't start from stopping, what can we do? So we'll talk a little bit about that, but it's about identification. It's so critical to taking step one. So I'm going to, and is it working out okay? Maybe by me removing this here, hopefully you guys can hear me good. I want to talk to you about toast and mayonnaise first. And I want to talk to you about baby aspirin. Did you do that? Okay. Yeah, I did that too. Sometimes on vision, we can get a sense, there's no hierarchy, right? There's no rock stars, there's no leaders, but we can get that feeling sometimes, right? And sometimes I could feel like, oh, I'm sharing. And the truth is, I'm sharing because I need to stay on this beam of recovery, and so I need to carry the message. So I really do it more for me than anyone, really. And that's just the truth. But if I'm helping somebody else, that's terrific. But I want to tell you a little bit about my story, maybe for the first 20 or so minutes, just give you some indication of what it was like for me. I want to talk about the baby aspirin. I'll get to the toast and mayonnaise in a second. The baby aspirin, I was about 3. And I remember that my mother she must have given me baby aspirin, and the sweet taste of the baby aspirin did something for me that it didn't do for other people, right? And so she had put the bottle of baby aspirin in the cabinets above the refrigerator, and I was a climber. And I knew enough at 3 years of age that I needed to get to that bottle of baby aspirin. I didn't have a headache. I wasn't hungry, right? But I needed to get to that bottle of baby aspirin. And I knew enough to make sure that she was out of the room. It was a Saturday morning. My father was out of the room. And I climbed up and I got that bottle of baby aspirin. It was before the days of childproof caps. And I proceeded to eat about 50, whatever was in the bottle, baby aspirin. And I remember my mother coming in the room shrieking. Can you imagine a 3-year-old? And I can remember her and my father taking me to the emergency room to have my stomach pumped, and I remember, and there was something about that baby aspirin, that sweet taste of the baby aspirin, when I think back about it, that did something for me that it didn't do for other kids, right? And so, when I reflect upon it, that was one of my earliest memories of compulsive eating and identifying in. I also remember the toast and mayonnaise, and I want to share about the toast and mayonnaise. I had a friend, you know, when we go to AA meetings, we talk about alcohol. You know, in OA, sometimes we're careful. As if me talking about toast and mayonnaise is going to take someone and they're going to immediately go get some toast and mayonnaise. They're going to do it anyway. I'm not worried. And those of you who are recovered are not. So I'm not too concerned. But it was my first sleepover. My friend Greg, I was about 7 years old. And we were doing what kids do, and we're playing, and we're doing, you know, this and that. Now, in my home, I come from sort of a lower middle class home at the time, and I'll take some of you back. Do you remember the generic section in the grocery stores? Can some of you remember? I don't even know if they still have that, but they did back in the day. In my home, all we had was generic things. We had generic diet pop, and we had generic bread, and we had generic everything. So I go to my friend Greg's house. There's Wonder Bread. There's Hostess Pop-Tarts. There's all this. It was like heaven. We're playing. We're doing our thing. And at some point, he's like, hey, let's go make some toast. Okay? And I saw this beautiful toaster, like an 8-slice toaster. I'd never seen such a miracle in my life. And he put in 2 pieces of toast, and he got out mayonnaise. Who does that? I never had that before. And he spread some mayonnaise, and I tried it. And it was like heaven. Because it did something for me that it didn't do for other people. Now, when he got done, Greg became disinterested. And he said, hey, let's go play. Let's go, you know, do whatever. Oh, no. I that toast and mayonnaise was in my, it was dancing. It might as well have been wearing like a parka and I mean, it was real and it was talking to me. Now here I am 7 years of age. It's probably midnight. His parents are asleep. I'm going down to make some Wonder Bread toast and mayonnaise. And I did. I proceeded to do that. And I probably had about 10 slices of toast and mayonnaise. See, because it did something for me that it didn't do for normal people. Normal people get disinterested in certain substances. Now, they may enjoy them. They may, you know, they may even overindulge at times. But for me, it did something for me. There was something different about me. I didn't become disinterested in those things. My father was a pharmacist. My father's deceased now. He had a pharmacy. It was not as big as this room. It was maybe a quarter of this room, the entire pharmacy. It was 3700 North Cicero Avenue in Wrigleyville area, for those of you that know the Chicago area. And it was in a corner, you know, apartment sort of building, and that's where he had Lad's Drugs. Larry, Andrea, David, Stephen, recognize whose name was first. Okay, Lad's Drugs, right? And so Lad's Drugs, what I remember about Lad's Drugs was not the drugs. What I remember was he had the candy section, and he had the Hostess section. And I would steal candy bars and Hostess Ding Dongs and chips and salty, savory, crunchy things. And I would take it at 8, 9, 10 years of age, and I would go downstairs in his little stock room, and I would proceed to eat those things, and I would hide the wrappers. Years later, when he's, and there was, don't worry about any like chocolate remnants or rats or anything, there was no remnants left, right? Years later, he found the wrappers. I hit him down there. See, because it did something for me that it didn't do for other people. You know, I graduated from that, and I later graduated to stealing not just candy bars, but money, because I got a little bit older, and I would take money right from the cash register. You know, maybe a 10 here, maybe a 20 there. And I didn't use it for heroin. I used it for food, because there wasn't enough food anywhere to satisfy me. And my parents later divorced when I was in the third grade, and we moved to California, Canoga Park, California. Is there some California people? All right, yeah. And we lived in, and I had a stepfather. Now he had 4 children. I have 2 older brothers, a younger sister. And he was abusive, and very abusive, physically abusive, emotionally abusive. And I would like to tell you that's why I'm a compulsive overeater, but that's not why I'm a compulsive overeater. I later learned why I am. It wasn't the things that happened to me that created created that condition in me. But we were there, and I can remember visiting my father maybe a couple times a year, and I would miss him so much, I would steal his cologne, his Old Spice cologne, because I needed to smell that, because it would bring me back and it would make me think about my dad. You know, and I remember those times, a very painful time. But during that time, food did something for me. It numbed me out from feeling much of anything. And I had anticipatory feelings about food that made me feel good and numbed me out. And it was the only thing that I looked forward towards. And, you know, as I got older, I did later on, I remember I'll speak a little bit about spirituality, about religion. You know, when I was in California, my stepfather had a sister, and she was institutionalized. I remember this. She was institutionalized. She had some sort of mental disorder. And lo and behold, she met a friend, apparently, when she was institutionalized, who introduced her to some type of spiritual, you know, maybe theology or something. And I remember that she got well. It wasn't a 12-step thing that I recall, but I remember my parents talking about her in such disparaging ways. They thought she was batshit crazy, you know, because anybody that would have a personal relationship with God was crazy. Now, we had a theology. It was a family-oriented thing, but if you had a personal relationship with God, you're a little bit crazy. Now, my parents never sat me down and, you know, lectured me about that, but the message came through very clear to me. So I wasn't brought up with any theological, any closeness or connection to a higher power. So that message came through. I just want to give you that understanding. And, you know, the disease continued to tighten its noose around my neck, but it would be years before I would begin to understand the progression of the disease. It tightened around my neck. I did graduate with an undergraduate degree in journalism. I had 5 roommates. I want to tell you about Pop-Tarts. I wanted to talk specifically about blueberry Pop-Tarts. I had now 5 roommates. We all had our own little cabinet, right, to keep our stuff. And my one roommate, he got the blueberry Pop-Tarts. And I wasn't going to eat his blueberry Pop-Tarts until I was, and I did, right? And I stole his blueberry Pop-Tarts and denied it like everyone else did. Well, they pulled the sting operation on me, and they realized who did it. And I remember coming back with my book bag, and I go back into my bedroom, and I put the book bag down, and I sit down on that bed and squish. And he had smeared a box of blueberry Pop-Tarts all on my sheets. And the shame that I felt, because he knew, and everyone else in the house knew that I stole the blueberry Pop-Tarts. You know, and so there was a lot of shame and secretiveness with this. And I wasn't a bad person. I was a sick person, and I didn't know how to get well. And food did something for me that it didn't do for other people. I eventually met my wife during undergrad, and we later had a daughter, Elizabeth, which leads me to share a little bit about the windshield. I was working on my doctorate in psychology. I was a very important man in my mind. And we were in Madison, Wisconsin. And we were driving back to the Chicago area for a family thing. And we were arguing about something. And I'm driving. My daughter's in the car seat in the back, as I recall. And we get to a point where we're getting off our gas. We're about 30 minutes away from home, back to Chicago. And we get off for gas, still arguing, and as I'm getting on the on-ramp, I'm going back towards Madison, but I don't realize it. And she doesn't realize it for about an hour. We finally realize it, and I'm holding the steering wheel like this, going 70 miles an hour, and I just, from end to end, spider webs. That was the type of person that I was. I'm not that same person today, but that was the type of explosive anger that I could engage in. That stopped the argument, and You know, she's a wonderful woman, a wonderful mother. She had the grace and the courage and the mercy to leave me at a certain point. Not right then, but she did. She did the right thing. Now, I didn't feel she did the right thing at the time. Who's leaving me? I mean, you know, I've got the degrees and I've got the this and the that. She did the right thing. And when I was able to make amends to her years later, is it? Okay. Is it coming through? Okay, good. When I was able to make amends to her years later, we were able to talk about that, and I was able to clean up my side of the street. I want you to know these things because sometimes, you know, you can see someone or you can hear somebody and you think, well, this person, you didn't know the guy. Nobody was looking for the guy that was 100 pounds heavier. And Jen has pictures. I'll share pictures. Nobody was, you know, looking for the guy that was busting windshields and stealing. Because I only wanted you to see the very best in me, and I hid, or so I thought I was hiding the things I didn't want you to see. You know, and it's not like that today. By the grace of God, it's not like that today. I don't talk about these things on Vision. You know, and like Kim was saying, you know, Vision is just, it's a big book study. There's nothing special there other than it's a big book study, and the big book is the only thing that got me well. It's the only thing that got me well. I tried other things, but it didn't work. You know, in the big book, in the chapter of Vision for You on page 151, it talks about coming to the awful awakening. Okay. Comes in and out. Maybe I should have just not hold it. Oh, is it a short one? Is this coming through?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So in the big book, thank you so much. In the big book, in the chapter of Vision for You on page 151, it talks about coming to the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, right? We've heard that before. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. See, I couldn't work a traditional 9-to-5 job because I couldn't practice my disease working a 9-to-5 job. One, I couldn't be around people. I knew that explosive anger at times, I knew the man that I was, I couldn't be around people that often. And yet, the person that brought the message to me, I'll tell you about that. This guy, he was a heroin addict for about 16 years sober. And he was coming to me on some other relational issues and so forth. And he said, and I shared this at the fire. I think I shared this at the bonfire last night. He came to me and he said, you probably can't relate to my heroin addiction. You know, we talked and I said, well, you're right. I probably can't. I said, but I have an issue with food. And he looked down and he said, because he was a 12-step guy, and he said, you know, I think there's something called Overeaters Anonymous. You might want to try that. He flipped the tables on me. Now, I couldn't pick this guy out of a lineup. You know, I could today. I couldn't, wouldn't know. But he carried the message. And I'd like to tell you that I immediately skipped over to the next OA meeting and put my food down, right, and embarked on the practical program of action and got well and to live happily ever after. That wasn't to be. I didn't even look into OA for another 6 months. At that point, but that was my but up until that, the noose around my neck began to tighten, and it got worse and worse, physically and emotionally. So, here's my journal entry from the very first OA meeting. Today was my first OA meeting. I can't believe I took the plunge. I'm scared and uncertain, but I'm grateful for doing this. It feels empowering. Although as I write this at 3:18 p.m., I'm hungry. I'm battling my binge demons. The cravings that I'm experiencing feel as powerful as a freight train. As they said today in the meeting, you have to work the program. They haven't explained how yet, so we shall see. I can't help noticing that I was the only guy at the meeting. Sounds a lot like OA, right? We're changing that, right, guys? We're changing that. There was a total of 10 women and me. Each person was certainly different, but all shared their latest episode of compulsive eating. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but there were people who identified as compulsive overeaters and others who identified as anorexic bulimics. Even the group leader described herself as a binge and purger. The leader read a few things about, you know, about the group and the purpose, etc. Then it seems each meeting will have a reading from one of their books. And after that, the meeting was open to sharing. I have to say, this reminds me of the depiction in so many movies where each person identifies themselves by saying, "Hi, my name is so-and-so. I'm a compulsive overeater." That's a bit strange. Then, of course, it's followed by a group echo, "Hi, so-and-so," and I put a big smile. It's my first meeting. I couldn't get myself to follow the protocol. I don't even know if I am a compulsive overeater. But after a while, I began to get the hang of it. I feel so frickin' fat. It's now 3:27. When's dinner? The group seemed very democratic. Nobody interrupted while someone else was speaking. Each person shared without monopolizing too much time. As I'm writing, I'm feeling hungry. I need to eat something soon, but what? They spoke about abstinence. What a concept. Sounds so AA to me. But it does make sense. I mean, if I'm out of control, where my life has become unmanageable, like they said, I need to abstain from overeating. So what am I feeling at this moment? Other than hungry? Did I say that a few times already? I'm feeling that I want or need a comforting feeling. Maybe this is what withdrawal feels like. Ugh. There's smart ones, Weight Watchers, I think I said meals in the freezer, but it's only 3:46 p.m. Perhaps a walk. Yes, that's what I'll do. See, I came to the meeting lacking clarity, without any real instructions. And they meant well, and they were wonderfully nurturing people. And I wanted to go out and make amends that very day. I remember hearing them talk a little bit about amends, and I wanted to go make amends that very day. See, if I can't start and I can't stop, what can I do? None of us gets to the doors of Overeaters Anonymous on a winning streak. I didn't get here on a winning streak. And I believed that food and weight were my problem because I was in a fat body, and all I could do is eat and eat and eat over and over again. So I thought that was my problem. I didn't understand. In chapter 3, more about alcoholism, it talks about the thinking that precedes taking that first bite. That was it for me, my thinking before taking that first bite. So Kim said something the other day about, see, I didn't eat the pizza. It was great when it got there, but my physiology changed just when I ordered the pizza. I bet if you hooked me up to a functional magnetic resonance imaging and you checked my pupil dilation, and I bet you would have seen that once I ordered the pizza, before it ever got there, my physiology began to... Right? What is it about the thinking that precedes that first bite? See, people... The chapter more about alcoholism is about people who were sober that made the decision to pick up liquor again. That's the crux of the problem. That's what they tell us. So we try to hunker down and we try to apply our willpower and tighten up my diet. And food was never my problem. We hear that again and again. Food was the solution to my problem. And we hear that. And it didn't really make sense to me. But food is the solution to my problem because it is the only thing that makes me feel relaxed and calm and normal and maybe comfortable in my own skin for a few minutes. Food was not the problem. It was the solution to my problem. And so for people like me, if food is the solution, what's the problem? And Harlan and others talk about the normal buildup of human emotion because we all have that normal buildup of human emotion. We feel joy. We feel jealousy. We feel anger. We feel fear. We feel all those things. But for someone like me, an addict, those feelings build up to a certain level where I can't bear it. And I can't take it anymore. And I need something so I can feel normal. And for me, the food gave me that sense of feeling normal for a few seconds. And I would do it over and over again. See, in a normal human being, the emotions become dissipated. They become dissipated when you do things. You read a book, you call a friend, you go for a jog, you go for a walk, and then your feelings become dissipated. They get back to normal, and you go on with your life. Not so with us. With us, I need food to make me feel comfortable in my own skin. I was a professor for many years of psychology, and I would go in big classes like this and bigger and some smaller, and I could not drive home at the end of the day without stopping into a drive-thru. It almost had like a gravitational pull. Now you think, what do you mean you couldn't stop? Sure you could. No, I'm telling you, for decades I could not, it became a joke to me. I could not make it home without stopping somewhere. There was something about this mental twist. There was something about, we learned about it. There's something about the allergy of the body that drove me back again and again. If you don't understand this problem, then any solution is going to get you there. We have to get clear on what the problem is. For me, here's what I did. I did not put the food down 100%. And I'll give you an example of how I didn't do that. So I said, oh, maybe sugar and flour, that's a common substance, right? And I'm not advocating for any particular food plan. And so then I found banana-flavored granola. And I looked on the ingredients, because I'm a corner cutter, man. And I didn't see sugar or fructose, and I didn't see flour. But I ate that banana-flavored granola like I ate Oreos until it was gone. So we got to get honest about our food, because I the first 5 years in program, I kept looking for a shortcut. What can I do to get a little bit of heroin? Just a little bit. I'm not going to do bags and bags of it. I'm just going to do a little bit. And so I continue to do that. And you know, I didn't understand, how could anyone stop with one or two pieces of chocolate? I had a friend that she ate two Hershey's Kisses every day. Who does that? Right? I couldn't understand how someone could eat two Hershey's Kisses and stop. It satisfied her. See, because the allergy of the body, the way I describe it, is the allergy of the body just means, however you want to look at it, it just means that when I pick up my alcoholic substance, it triggers a phenomenon of craving, right? Where my desire for more does not get satisfied, it gets amplified. And that's not normal. It's not normal for your desire to become intensified or amplified. That's all that allergy means to me. And if that were my only problem, that would be pretty bad. But I have a much bigger problem, which is this mental twist, which suggests that even when I put my alcoholic substances down, which I may do for weeks and months, for some reason that feeling comes back to me. And I pick up and I trigger the phenomenon of craving, and I'm right back out eating again. And it's repeated over and over again, even when you're here in OA. Because statistically speaking, there's probably 10 people that are eating their alcoholic substances, probably more. And I was with you. I understand. You're not a morally bad person because you have an untreated condition. What the steps do is they treat. What can we do? We work the steps because they treat an untreated condition. And the thing for me is, because I believe in science, I've always believed in science. I'm trained in scientific methodology and all that stuff. So wait a minute. You're telling me that I'm going to work these steps and something's going to happen to me where I'm not going to want the food, and you're telling me I'm going to be happy about it? No chance. You know why I know there's no chance? Because it's never happened to me. So don't tell me that it's possible for me. How dare you tell me that that can happen, because it's never happened to me. My perceptive lens was wrong. I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know that this program is not about science. That bothered me. I wanted the program to be about science, because if it is, I'm going to win, baby. Because I can read and comprehend really good, and I'm a great test taker, and I could regurgitate stuff like nobody's business, so I'm going to win. And it's not about that. And that's why I didn't recover. And I continue to... Now, I had 8 sponsors in the first 5 years, but I was sponsoring myself. Don't kid yourself. Now, I called them right when they told me to call them. If they said 602, I'm going to call it 602, maybe 601. And here's how it's going to go. And I never told him this. You're going to take my emotional temperature each day. We're going to talk about my feelings. Because, see, I know something you don't. I know about psychoanalytic theory and peeling away the layers of the onion and bringing this stuff up and processing it. You don't know about that. So we're just going to talk this through. It's about group support. It's not about science. I tried that. I'm a big fan of therapy. It doesn't work if you're like me. It doesn't work. And so I continued again and again to sponsor myself. And then I would find a spot. Who's got the goods? Who's the one? You know, I'll call Harlan. I'll call this one. I want the celebrity sponsor because he or she is going to get me well. And that's not how this works. There is nobody with the goods. Where's Charles? Charles talks about, was it Boo Boo Kitty can be your sponsor? That cracks me up. Chuck says Boo Boo Kitty could be your sponsor. If you're ready, anybody could be your sponsor. But you need a Sherpa. You know, I don't want a Sherpa that's never been to the top of the mountain. Now, you know, I want someone who's taken the steps that can hold the lantern and begin to walk with me. And say, oh, yeah, I've been down here before. Don't trip over that. But what's happening, see, I want you to take a stroll with me back to the 1940s. You're sick and suffering. You have an untreated condition. You're a gutter alcoholic. And you venture into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and here's what you can expect that would happen. They would welcome you. They would introduce you to all the people. You'd know everyone's name. And they would tell you, they'd sit you down and they'd say, okay, this is how it's going to go. Oh, they'd assign you a sharing partner. They didn't use the word sponsor. That's okay, we understand. Sharing partner, sponsor. And that sharing partner would sit you down and say, okay, look, over the next 4 weeks, this week, tonight, if you choose to stay, we're going to go over the first 3 steps. We're going to talk about what your problem is, what the solution to your problem is, and then in step 3, we're going to talk about how to bring that solution to light. Then from there, next week when you come back, oh, your alcohol? Yeah, no, you can't be drunk while you're doing this, right? Yeah, you got to put your alcohol down, right. Next week if you come back, we're going to go over steps 4 and 5 where you are going to do a thorough and fearless moral inventory. We're going to show you how to do that. We're going to help you. Oh, your hand's shaking? Yeah, they were gutter drunks. I'm going to help you write. It's all part of our history. And then from there, in between the weeks of 2 and 3, you would give away your 5th step. And then you come back. If you don't run like hell and you come back, we're going to go through steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, where you will begin the process to make amends. You'll go out and make amends. And then when you come back, you will be a recovered alcoholic. And then guess what you get to do? You get to be a sharing partner for the next person in 4 weeks. Now, I'm not saying that's how you have to do the program. I am saying that's how the program was developed by our pioneers, right? They had an astonishing rate of recovery. Astonishing rate of recovery. People were getting well. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have beautiful meetings like this. They didn't, you know, and people were getting well. So let's fast forward to September 2018. Not this room. You're sick and suffering, compulsive overeater, alcoholic, and you venture into a room. They may identify you as a newcomer. They may welcome you. They may introduce you to everyone there. They may not. They may talk about the steps They may not. They may talk about sponsorship. They may not. And given the fact that the topic and discussion meetings, from what I understand from World Service, it's like 7-1 versus literature meetings, i.e. big book meetings. You're probably going to hear the stories of people. You're going to hear about foreclosure and people losing jobs and spousal abuse, and you're going to hear those things. And I'm not minimizing those things. Group therapy and support is wonderful. I'm just saying you're not going to be embarking on getting well. The rate of recovery in Overeaters Anonymous, we're not talking 50%, we're not talking 30%, we're not talking 20%, we're not talking 5%, right? Are we talking 5%? We're lucky to be maybe 2%. Now, if that's disturbing, it is disturbing to me as well. Because oftentimes, and it's not just OA, it's AA too. For those of you, I go to AA meetings, you know, the person in many OA meetings that's leading the meeting is drunk, right? Now he or she is a very nurturing, kind person. We're not taking their inventory. I'm not, you know, saying something, you know, but they're still drunk. They just don't reek of alcohol. Can you imagine going, for those of you that go to AA, walking in the room, and the person who's reeking of alcohol is leading the meeting? And we wonder why our rates of recovery are not very strong. It's troubling. It's troubling indeed. So Vision for You, there's nothing special about Vision. There's no Vision for You way. There's no Vision for... Someone called me once and said, as an elder... Elder? Really? Not only... I mean, I am getting a little bit older. I am older. Elder? What are you talking about, elder? I don't have any say-so. I'm another person attending this meeting because to stay alive. That's why I come and share. And it was as an elder, I think blah 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 blah, right? You know, there is no it's you know what got me well? Following the steps as laid out in the first 164 pages of the big book in sequence. With my food, my alcoholic substance being down 100%, and being willing to go through a period of uncomfortability. The first 5 years, I wasn't willing to go through that period of uncomfortability. Within a few miles from here, someone put heroin down last night. Somebody probably did, right? You're like, do you know him or her? No. And they are, I know this because I've treated people and been involved in that world. They are vomiting. They are having maybe psychotic episodes. They're shaking. Sounds a little bit uncomfortable. Kind of sounds like putting down your food 100%. You might not vomit. You might not sweat. You may. But you're going to feel horribly uncomfortable because it's called withdrawal. And only someone who's desperate and dying will do that. Now, there are people in this room. They're compulsive readers by definition, but they're bulimics. They're anorexics. Same thing with the behavior. When you stop sticking your head in the toilet bowl, it's going to feel very uncomfortable. It extends to behaviors as well, right? Just like a gambler. That behavior brings them a sense of ease and comfort. And it becomes horribly uncomfortable, you know, almost to the point of shaking when they can't gamble. So it's going to take someone desperate, right? It's not for the faint of heart. And I wasn't ready to put it down. I talked about the granola. There's other things. I looked for the little, I'm going to work this program smart, not hard. You know, I'm going to do this my way. And the reality is I didn't get well. So I would go, I would go like on a Saturday. Here was my plan at a certain point. I'm going to go to 3 meetings back to back to back. I'm not going to be eating while I'm in the meeting. I'll eat in the car, right? I'll eat on my way home. And I thought that was insurance. There is no protection anywhere. The other thing, you know, in the 1940s, you didn't have to like search around from, you know, from from Denver to Miami to Manitowoc for a sponsor. You were assigned a sharing partner. What is this business where we search for the perfect person? There is no perfect person. Who are we kidding? And I did that. It's not when you're ready, anybody can sponsor you that's been through the process. It takes a level. You know, for me, what had to happen is I had to, it says, we have to have a spiritual awakening, a sufficient, effective spiritual awakening. No one can define for you what the spiritual awakening is, but we have to have an effective spiritual awakening. And when we do, something's going to happen. Change. The whole program is about an internal restructuring where we change. And that happened to me once I put the heroin down. I remember one, and it could happen again. I remember someone, because I used that imagery. I've never done heroin. But I've used that imagery because it's deadly, this disease. And I had someone come up to me and they said, you know, my daughter died of a heroin overdose. I don't appreciate you talking about heroin. And I felt bad about that. And I felt remorse and so forth. And I called, prayed about it, and I called some others, and I thought along about it, this is a killing disease. I've seen people, if you've been around, you see people die of this disease. And it doesn't say, you know, compulsive overeater on their death certificate, right? It's never going to say that. It's going to be heart disease and complications for diabetes, pneumonia as a complication of something, whatever it is. You don't see too many morbidly obese people in their 70s and 80s, do you? I mean, if we're honest about it. Nor do you see too many people in their 70s and their 80s and beyond that are 80 pounds either. This isn't to suggest that the thinnest person in the room is the healthiest. We know that's not true, right? But what I am saying is it takes working the steps. We talk about like our hair's on fire. It's just another way of social alignment that brings about happiness and contentment in the midst of calamity, in the midst of calamity. What if I have a way to substitute that where I don't want the food anymore and I could be happy about it? What if I could have that? You know what we call that process? Recovery. Recovery. It happens by working the steps. And I remember standing in my kitchen. It's many years ago now. And I knew I was different. It was the first time I had put the food down 100% and I'd worked the steps imperfectly. You don't work the steps perfectly because, I don't know, you're human. You couldn't work the steps perfectly if you tried. But you work the steps, and I remember doing it, and I knew something was different. And it was like a dimmer switch for me, right? It wasn't the light switch, it just came on. And I felt different, and the obsession was lifted, and it's never returned. Now, since that time, my dad has died. There's been financial insecurities. There's different jobs. There's people get sick. It wasn't like on that day, this beautiful bubble was built around me where now the bad stuff doesn't happen, that people don't step on my toes. No, I'm still human. I'm susceptible to all those things. What happened was the obsession was placed in remission, contingent upon staying in fit spiritual condition. And staying in fit spiritual condition is not hard. I just come to Denver, I get on the vision line, right? I mean, I know it's a little bit, there's precise instructions, right? But I mean, but it's not that hard because what happens through the process is now we have a desire to want to carry the message so that we can stay on the beam of recovery and I become detached from their outcome because since the God job is taken, they're not accepting any more applications for that job, I don't apply. So whether you get well, I can assure you that Ginger didn't get well, I tell her this, because of Larry K. Really, right? I mean, is that so hard? Because most people that have worked with Larry K do not get well. That's just the reality. But I still carry the message. I say 9 out of 10. They're not ready. They're not, you know, they're just, they haven't experienced enough pain. And I, in the most compassionate way, say, well, there's a timing and a rhythm to it. If you're not ready, you'll know where to find me. Where am I going? You know, I'm not going anywhere. And then, you know, and then you move on to the next person. And that is the most compassionate thing we can do, I think, right? That's probably the most compassionate thing. Because I think, and I'll wrap up by saying, I think that in OA, we come in the rooms and we are lovely, nurturing, caring people. And we will hold your hand and we will hug you and we will walk with you hand in hand. We won't push you in your grave, but we'll watch as you jump in your grave. And it's troubling to me because people are dying. So, anyways, this has been, and with that, on such a positive note, we're not a glum lot, right? We're not a glum lot. Because to see people get well, to see someone who had candy up in her room, and she's not perfect, right? Who is perfect in this room? But to see the light come on is the most extraordinary thing, to see the light come on in someone's eyes. It's something you shouldn't miss. I think you snuck that in my book. It's something you should not miss, is to see someone get well. It's the most magnificent thing. Anyway, with that, I will pass. Thank you.